KJZZ's original production, The Show, is supported by Banner Health, Arizona's largest nonprofit healthcare system. Last year, Banner reinvested more than $1.1 billion in community health and charity care. Banner Health, nonprofit for Arizona. BannerHealth.com/nonprofit4AZ.
Hi, I'm Mark Brody, co-host of The Show, an original production from KJZZ. Every weekday, we bring you the latest news and culture from across the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode. Good morning. It's The Show here on KJZZ 91.5 in Phoenix. I'm Mark Brody. Coming up, the feds have provided some details of Colorado River cuts to Arizona and the other basin states. And an L.A. artist finds a new home in Tucson. But first, it is time for the Friday newscap and some voices from the news this week.
We were hoping to have voters be able to have a say this November on how much we all know they dislike vouchers. Instead, we're going to have to spend some more time speaking to them about how we got to this place where $1 billion of our taxpayer dollars is being spent on this program.
I spent 8 years in the legislature watching attacks on our constitutional right to citizens initiative and continuing to raise the bar on getting measures on the ballot. And I voted against most of those, probably all of them.
I know that if you see a debate between us, you'll vote for Andy Biggs. And you know what? They know it too. And that's why they're not going to show up for a debate. But I'll be there.
All we're asking is reimbursement for the good work we've done in Arizona to protect our citizens. And we put that back forward to continue to sustain what we're doing.
I felt like I needed to be there to advocate for people like myself that were being shoved out of the party. A few months ago, I realized that's a lost cause right now.
And with me to talk about the ballot measures we will and will not be voting on this fall, some new polls in the governor's race and more, are Christine Jones, former congressional and gubernatorial candidate. Christine, good morning.
Good morning.
And Stacey Pearson of Lumen Strategy. Stacey, good morning, too.
Good morning.
Stacey, I'm going to start with you. Prop 212, which was a measure that Public Teachers Union and some others put on to try to make some changes to the state's ESA program. We can't call them vouchers. We learned that from the state Supreme Court this year. That is not going to be on the ballot. They turned in an awful lot of signatures, it seems, to not have enough to qualify.
Oh, it's heartbreaking. And with citizens' initiatives, it really is death by a thousand paper cuts. It is – the cost is extraordinary. The strict compliance standard is insane. And to explain what that means, if you put PHX instead of the word Phoenix in the box that is for the city – your entire signature can be disqualified. If you transpose your address or your printed name or the any mistakes in that line, if you color outside the box, if your signature, if the Y in Stacy goes down to the box below, the entire line can be disqualified. And so what winds up happening is the wealthiest among us have to bankroll citizens' initiatives now, and they're no longer in the hands of citizens.
Is there, I hate to put it this way, but like, is there blame to be assigned here?
The blame to be assigned is in the legislature's ongoing attempt to undermine our ability to have direct democracy. I mean, this is direct democracy was enshrined in the state's constitution. We held out for it. Arizona, the 48th state, held out its constitution for direct democracy. And the legislature in the past decade has chipped away at it in a way that really means direct democracy must be purchased. It can no longer be just grassroots.
Christine, is it surprising that I guess the end result here and the number of signatures that ultimately were disqualified?
Well, first of all, the number of signatures they got was significantly huge.
Yeah.
I mean, we're talking over 400,000 signatures, as to Stacey's point, very expensive. They needed, 60% of that or something. So, we all go and get additional signatures just to guard against these strict compliance. Here's the problem. The rules matter, and we should ask people to comply with them. But this thing that we're doing of challenging every single initiative on both sides do it. Every single initiative gets a lawsuit or more. And, basically saying to the citizens, you don't get to play this game anymore.
Right.
Like, if we don't want to do it, let's just eliminate it altogether, because it is too onerous to get something on the ballot. The legislature can refer it pretty easily, gets over – well, they could have if they had done it right – get over there pretty cleanly. And, you know, the procedural thing is important. I'm a lawyer. I like to follow rules. But it honestly, come on. What are we doing? Voucher is a term of art. We're all calling it vouchers, and suddenly now we can't call it voucher. So, you know, I feel like it's a little bit of form over substance at this point.
Well, it feels like what you're describing is sort of the letter of the law versus the spirit of the law. Is that a fair assessment?
Yeah, I think that's a good way to say it, right? So we're saying the conservative position should be, we don't want fraud in the ESA system. We don't want people to have to spend their money on a Chanel watch or say, for example, a Nordic track or a trip to Disneyland. We want that fraud to be eliminated. And that's something that we should all try to vote on, right? Do we want you to get to pick what I do with my education dollars? No, I don't want that either, right? So these sorts of things matter. But the problem is, if we're going to eliminate all of the signatures, even the duplicates, just because your name appeared on there twice, that feels like form over substance.
So, Stacey, we heard from some of the folks who are pushing this, because, you know, obviously there's a good amount of money, as you both
right.
alluded to, involved in this, talking about, okay, well, now maybe we will put our efforts toward the legislature. Do you think those efforts will be any more successful than their effort to get this Prop 212 on the ballot?
So, to Christine's point, yes, it is going to be more successful, because people are motivated by rage right now. And we talk a lot about the waste and fraud and abuse, and to the point that I think that phrase is becoming less meaningful. But we have no accountability on these homeschool kids. They are not taking standardized tests. I have no idea if the weirdos down the street from me are teaching their kids that we're on a round planet called Earth that orbits the sun, or that 2 + 2 = 4 and not 22. I have no idea what those kids on the bikes all hours of the day, every day of the week, are actually learning. They are not being tested. So we're, as a society, we're going to have to deal with the worst homeschooled kids who think Earth is flat at some point.
I feel like your next neighborhood block party is going to be a little more awkward now.
Oh, man, it's weird. There's a guy that I refer to as Don Jr. At some point, he's going to figure out I call him that, too. So, yes.
Yeah, so last time Stacey called the homeschoolers weirdos, I got in trouble, like as if I was the one that did it. So
it was kooky. I said kooky.
Let's just state for the record, there are a lot of homeschool students who are rock stars. Mm-hmm. I know a lot of them.
Absolutely.
And they are very, very well
and
educated.
And they can take a test.
They should be able to take a test
and show me what rock stars they
They've
are.
They've gone on to great schools and they've become very well educated. They're not kooks, okay? They're not weirdos, but they should have accountability, I think, is your point.
Yeah.
Christine, do you think that the groups who are pushing this ballot measure, do you think that they will be able to – obviously their goal is now to flip the legislature so that they can get some of these changes that they wanted in the ballot measure through the legislature, which will never happen with the Republicans in charge. Do you think they have a chance?
I don't – I know there's a couple of really strong efforts to flip the legislature that the Democrats are running. I'm not as – bullish on that as they are, because I just think that there are enough legislative districts that are still leaning Republican mm-hmm. that they're probably pretty easy for the Republicans to pick up. I wouldn't sleep on it if I was a GOP candidate in some of those districts, because some of these people are very, very likable, really well-spoken, smart, thoughtful, community-minded people. So I do think that their efforts are good. Are they going to flip it? Probably not. However, the conservative position here and what the legislature should do is to say, we want to build in some safeguards.
Mm-hmm.
We really care about parents being the first and best educators of their children. We want them to pick where their education dollars go. But we also are conservatives fiscally, and we don't want people wasting the money. That is an okay thing for Republicans to do, and they should, because citizen initiatives, amending the Constitution, enshrining this permanently, is probably not the best way for us to legislate. The legislature should be doing that.
Are you surprised that the legislature hasn't done that yet?
I'm surprised they did it badly. I think the Republicans got too cute. They tried to get the military family exemption. They tried to get two bites at the apple, which we all know in the rules you cannot do. It has to be just a mm-hmm. one-issue ballot measure. They could have handled this, and you know, instead they slopped it up. So I hope they come back around. I hope they build in the safeguards. Let's not spend millions upon millions of dollars collecting signatures next time. Let's have thoughtful legislators get together, say, look, we're going to deal with this on a bipartisan basis. It's not controversial. We all want our parents to choose our education models and let the legislature refer it cleanly.
One more question on this, Stacey, before we move on. Any chance, for example, the Secretary of State's race gets a little more juice because of this? I mean, that's the primary on the GOP side was almost all about vouchers.
Right. I mean, folks are paying closer attention to democracy writ large, and specifically direct democracy. I mean, this folks who were circulating petitions, and I was entirely too close to this issue. We had a Protect the Vote initiative to enshrine our ability to vote by mail and vote early in the Constitution. We didn't get enough signatures. It was constitutional. We would have needed $15 million, someone to write a check like that.
That's a real number?
That's a real number. Wow. I mean, it's nuts. We are way beyond the ability to have direct democracy without a billionaire funder. It's nuts. But yes, to answer the question, certainly folks are paying attention and they're frustrated that they signed. They want accountability built into the education system. No one's talking about taking away parental rights. But if you are telling me you're educating your kid at home, have them take the test. I want to make sure they can add. We're going to have to deal with these kids when they're grown up. Like, make sure the earth's not flat. Go ahead. Test them.
Christine, you alluded to the military family bill prop, which would have been Prop 145, also contained the so-called poison pill, which would have nullified Prop 212. Had that passed, a whole long, convoluted thing. Given that Prop 212 is not going to be on the ballot, is this, pardon the pun, less of a bitter pill for Republicans to swallow that this one, there's also got kicked off the ballot?
Yeah, I think so. You know, look, school choice won, but it was procedural, right? It was by accident. So, yeah. It's a temporary sort of Pyrrhic victory. It's not real because we still have to Stacey's point, we still have to come back around and fix the fraud. You know, Tom Horn had the audacity to say we should put some safeguards in the system, and he got primary challenged and beat. So it's a temporary fake victory. We'll take it for the minute. We won't take ESAs away from people, which is always the goal here. But it's got to get fixed.
Stacey, is there any hindsight at this point, which, of course, is always 2020, from those on the left that, gosh, you know, maybe we should have taken that deal in the legislature when they were offering some kind of guardrails in exchange for, you know, us dropping the ballot measure?
I mean, certainly hindsight's 2020, right? Getting a little bit of something is better than a lot of nothing, as it turns out. But I think the optimism is that Democratic enthusiasm among voters is as high as I've ever seen it. And it's the only way Democrats are going to be able to secure statewide seats. I mean, we have a registration disadvantage that's as high as it's been in a decade. I mean, we have 300,000 less Democrats registered to vote than Republicans, 200,000 fewer than independents. And so a whole of a half million voters, it means that we have to turn out our base in a way that overcomes those disadvantages. So, I mean, yes, we're looking at really all options and ideally flipping a chamber in the legislature to try to get some of this done.
Are ESAs the issue that will continue to excite the Democratic base for this election, do you think?
I think ESAs education is always among the top three issues. And folks are getting increasingly frustrated with campus closures, with their neighborhood school going away. I mean, this is and that affects your property value. It affects where your kid. I mean, it changes the way you get up in the morning and get your kids off to school.
Yeah.
I mean, if your commute's now 30 minutes and not 10 or 5 or I mean, it changes the way people live.
Interesting. Christine, one more ballot measure. This one we will be voting on. The state Supreme Court said we will. But we will have a description of it that is okayed by Secretary of State Fontes. So it sounds like both sides got a little bit. This is a Prop 144, a bunch of changes to the way that elections are done, but not a lot of details on how some of those changes might actually be played out. We've been talking about, you know, ballot measures that maybe excite voters, get them to the polls. Is this one that those on the right might be excited to come out and vote for?
I don't think so. It feels like a little bit of a sleeper. And honestly, you know, Adrian Fontes fighting over wording, is it voucher or is it ESA or is it ACEs or whatever? It's so boring. And it's, you know, Stacey talking about flat earthers, that's interesting, right? Me talking about is ESA money going to a private school, it's interesting. How you style the ballot initiative, so boring. Here's what might motivate people. Nobody wants to be misled. Nobody wants all of the double, triple, quadruple negatives. And if you vote yes, it means no. And if you vote no, it means yes. And you don't really know what you're saying. And the other thing that I think really offends people because they're not stupid is describe what the thing does. Don't advocate to me. Don't make the description adversarial. Don't make it try to tip me in one way or the other. Just say what it is. For the love of God, could we not just have some kind of plain language without any advocacy for a change? That, I think, might be motivating.
Christine, we've seen in the past, like in the last cycle, there were a number of ballot measures that the Republican legislature put on the ballot, didn't really spend much money on in terms of having a campaign for it, and many of them failed. I'm curious what you see for this particular one. Like, is this one that Republicans are going to maybe put some money, put some effort toward trying to convince voters to vote for it?
I haven't heard of anybody. Nobody's called me and asked me for a check, as an example. So I don't actually know, but my sense is it's way down the totem pole when you have something like Save Girls Sports and 318 coming. That's a much more important issue on a bipartisan basis. You know, the vast, vast, vast majority of both, or actually all three party registration designations are in favor of that.
And so, this is one that you're working on.
Fair disclosure. Yeah. I support it. Most parents don't want their minor daughters changing in, you know, showering with boys. So biological boys. So I think that's probably more motivational. And there's just a limited amount of money to go around. You know, the Terry Goddard initiative that made the disclosures important has really discouraged out-of-state money. So now you're just really limited to the donors in-state. To Stacey's point, how many billionaires are there that want to put $15 million behind one of these?
Right.
It's got to be something sexy. It's got to be something that's interesting and something that impacts them, their children, their grandchildren, you know, somebody.
Do you agree, Stacey? I mean, election integrity is like, it seems like one of the few things the president, for example, really enjoys talking about all the time. Like, it's a pretty consistent Republican talking point.
Well, and in full disclosure, we're working on the no campaign on 144. And it is undeniably a path to end mail in voting and early voting. That's it. I mean, it's in the language that the legislature will continue to control and essentially the path to end mail-in voting. So I find it hilarious that 80% of the voters in November will cast their mail-in ballots. If they vote yes on 144,
it's the last time.
If you vote yes to end the very method by which you vote, it's lunacy. And so, yes, I think 144 is going to get interesting, and that was very much a response to the proactive constitutional amendment that we were running to enshrine mail-in voting rights in the state's constitution.
Yeah. Is there public polling on that?
Oh, yeah. It's
been released on 144?
I don't know.
Sorry, I
didn't
mean to
derail you. On 144, no. But yes, it will be soon.
Yeah.
I mean, they're going to have to spend millions and millions and millions to try to fool voters into voting against their own way of voting.
Interesting. Okay, so guys, let's talk about a couple of polls looking at the governor's race. There was a poll from Noble Predictive Insights. It found that Governor Hobbs is leading Andy Biggs by 13 points, 48% to 35. This is, of course, that's a pretty big margin, especially considering that the governor won by, 17,000 4 years ago. Another poll from American Encore found the governor up 45 to 40. It seems like both polls have the governor roughly in the same, like in the ballpark, like mid to upper 40s. Not quite 50,
right,
but mid to upper 40s. But, you know, they both have her up, but one obviously by a lot more. Obviously, polls, snapshot in time. You know, we're still, 3 months away from the election. What do you make of these, Christine?
I mean, as a candidate, we tend to try to disregard the horse race polls as much as possible. Two things that I would say stand out here. First of all, there's no good way to spin this. These are both bad for Biggs on a statistical purpose. There's two things I thought were really interesting. Hobbs has already consolidated 86% of Democrat support, and Biggs is only at 75% of Republicans. So fully 1 in 4 Republican voters are saying that they don't support him. That's a problem for Biggs, whether you're behind 5 or 13. The other thing is, at 48, Hobbs already has 48 support in Mike Noble's poll, 45 in the other. She's almost at the tipping point. I think this is a bad, bad sign for Biggs. And I think the Republicans got to have a thing to get people to get that 300,000 vote advantage at the polls to vote for the top of the ticket by some other means than being excited about the candidates, because they don't seem to be particularly excited about the candidates this cycle.
What do you think, Stacey?
The death knell of any candidate is when they say the only poll that matters is
the
election day results.
But it's true, right, to some extent.
And I saw a big supporter on X this week say exactly that. I'm like, oh.
A big supporter?
Yeah. You're, look at you dusting off your resume. This is key. Like it is very difficult. First, Katie Hobbs has never lost an election, hard stop. She's never lost. And it is very.
Has Biggs? I don't think Biggs is either.
Question. It is very difficult to unseat a Republican. Or I'm sorry, unseat
an incumbent.
An incumbent. Yeah. It's very difficult to unseat an incumbent. And she's done a perfectly lovely job. She is. It's so funny, the criticism about it not being more exciting. I want a governor to be boring. Go be boring. Go just do policy stuff. Go stay out of the news. I appreciate it very, very much. I think we need to make leadership boring again.
So, I mean, obviously it's better to be up 13 or 5 than down, but there's still so much time, Stacey, before Election Day. There's going to be debates that the governor and her running mate will not be participating in, that Andy Biggs and his running mate, Sina Kerr, will be participating in. There's going to be lots of stuff happening between now and then. Like, is it, I mean, I assume if you're the Hobbs campaign, you don't want to just assume, okay, look, these polls show we're up, we're good, because, like, certainly not, the race is not over.
Well, and she has the money advantage, right? The governor has fundraised an extraordinary amount of money. She has the support, full support of the Democratic Governors Association, the DGA. So we're talking tens of millions of dollars that are coming into the state to talk about her record and to make a debate more irrelevant. And the Republican machinery has not invested the same way in Andy Biggs for a variety of reasons. Some of which I'm certain are these poll numbers, that he is at an extraordinary disadvantage and his voting record is not one that is standing the test of time. I mean, he's got some issues with the votes that he took in the legislature. And I think some of that is being reflected in the poll because the governor herself has the financial advantage to be able to remind people that he voted to protect the Colorado City pedophiles.
Well, and how significant is that money advantage? I mean, Andy Biggs is somebody who's never really had to raise a ton of money because he's always been in very safe legislative and congressional districts. Obviously, there will be turning point money, and you would think that resources wouldn't be a concern, but maybe they will be.
Yeah, I'm surprised at the stark difference, frankly, the big gap between the Hobbs money and the Biggs money. Does TP Action or Turning Point come in? Probably, right? Although I have to say, the negative ads that are being run against Biggs are widely ineffective. They're meaningless. People turn off the television or turn down the volume when they come on. So I think if the DGA is to spend a lot of money, they got to improve their ads. But look, the Republicans, and particularly somebody like Biggs, who's been in the East Valley, he's been in office a long time. He's been in a very safe conservative Republican seat the entire time, no matter what the legislative district number was or the congressional district. And he's used to being able to win a primary, win a general. That's not the case here, right? We are legitimately a swing state now. I hate to admit it live on the air, but we are purple. We have two Democratic senators, and it matters who we pick in the primary. And we haven't done a good job of, I'll just acknowledge it. We haven't done a good job of that as Republicans, and we got to get better at it because ideologues are not winning general elections. I will say one other thing. Katie Hobbs should debate. I think it should be an obligation for people who want the public trust. We call it public service, and it should be about serving the public, not yourself. I did 55 debates when I ran for governor. She can do one. That is obnoxious for her to hide in the basement and not debate and come out and just answer some policy questions. Andy Biggs is not Carrie Lake. He's not a flamethrower. He will have a thoughtful policy conversation with her, and she should show up.
All right. Unfortunately, we'll have to leave it there. Christine Jones, Stacey Pearson, thanks to you both. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody. Coming up in the next installment of our summer soapbox series, what happens to a friendship when you commit to a 12-hour road trip beach day? But first, in Tucson, a chubby U of A boy with shaggy hair adjusts his backpack as he and his friend head up to University Boulevard, and he's saying, "Music's terrible now and the world's ending. What's the point?" as a hummingbird alights upon a Palo Verde. That's just one of the astute observations about the Old Pueblo that our next guest documents on her social media and soon in a new book of poetry and prose titled In Tucson. Britt Warner is not just a writer, though, and she's not just a poet. She's something of a jack of all trades. She's an artist, musician, writer, Pilates instructor, and childhood equestrian whose writing is as varied as her interests. She moved to Tucson after the wildfires in her hometown of Los Angeles, and many of her poems are about acclimating to the desert. My co-host Lauren Gilger spoke with her more about that.
I grew up a competitive equestrian rider, so I jumped and missed a ton of school, ended up culminating the junior career at Madison Square Garden in the finals there. So that focus can be applied to pretty much anything. The creative stuff was so instinctive and just part of who I was and am from the get-go. So I think it can be confusing for people to try to put me in a box, and that's ultimately their problem. To me, it all makes sense.
Yeah. You're from Los Angeles, right? You spent a lot of time working and living as an artist there?
Yeah, born and raised in LA. I realized for quite a few years I didn't want to stay in LA and just didn't know where else I wanted to be. And then in January of 2025, the fires destroyed the towns of Altadena and Pacific Palisades. Yeah. I lived near Altadena. We had to get out of there. And my sister-in-law's best friend lives in Tucson. Her father has a duplex and Airbnbs one side. And they said, come on down, get out of there. Let's just have you wait it out here. So that was how I got to Tucson.
Had you ever been there before?
I, like so many people, have passed through on the 10 on the way to somewhere else.
Right.
Yeah. But no, I had no idea what to expect, no expectations. I just remember waking up on that first morning and it was so quiet. And I walked to the nearest cafe and sat down with my journal and coffee and began to write about what I was experiencing. And haven't stopped.
Were you surprised by your reaction to this place? Did you expect to like it, to love it, to stay?
No, I had no expectations. I just felt a sense of calm. And when I got back to LA, I missed Tucson and began to pack up my life, say my goodbyes to everybody. I took a trip out to Tucson to look at places to live and throw some stuff in storage, and fully committed in a way that I never have to another place outside of California, and was determined to let another environment shape me for some time. I remember when I was staying here during the fires and my host was showing me around downtown, there was this sense of people just hanging out, like not running around frenetically. It didn't feel as anxiety ridden. There was just this sense of peace that called to me. Yeah, here I am.
Yeah. So you're getting to know this place and it sounds like you're doing it through your writing. Like you write these kind of interesting little snippets, musings, maybe observations, like little pieces of poetry about Tucson. When did you start doing that? Was that on that first morning when you woke up in Tucson during the fires?
No, it was a little bit before coming to Tucson when the fires hit. I began posting on Threads because I was trying to process everything in real time. And what better place than social media? I say that tongue in cheek. And then once I moved to Tucson, I didn't know a ton of people, but wanted a place to put the feelings I was experiencing, the observations I was making, but also it was a way to entertain myself. That's what writing and art have always been to me, is first and foremost to make myself happy or to figure out exactly what I think And yeah. often I don't know until I can see it written out in front of me.
Yeah. So I want to read a few of these because they're sometimes funny, sometimes really serious, sometimes really beautiful. One of my favorites is this one. It says, after it rains in Tucson, the smell of creosote seeps through the thinly paned windows, beyond the mesquite shutters, past the saguaro-ribbed ceiling and into my parched soul, which I love. And that smell of creosote to anyone who lives in the Sonoran Desert is so emblematic of this place.
It's so distinct. Even before it rains here, the creosote begins to emit a fragrance that is unlike anything else I've ever smelled. And it carries a nostalgia for, of course, the people who've lived in Arizona forever, but even to those of us who are new to it, it feels emotionally resonant.
Yeah. But it helps you, it sounds like, process it and realize what it is that you love about this place by writing it down.
Absolutely. That and just wherever you are in the world, there's always something you can complain about or find to be problematic. And I find it's really helpful to continue to notice things as an observer, as an anthropologist, to stay curious, to stay interested, to keep my sense of humor, because I can err on the too serious side at times. So, yeah, it's just a lot of fun.
But some of these are funny. I mean, you also write, if you'd braved the Trader Joe's parking lots in L.A. for as many years as I had, you would move to Tucson, too.
Okay, funny thing, I went to the Trader Joe's, a new one off of Broadway here, just the other day with my boyfriend, and he was already like lamenting how crowded the parking lot was here. And I just looked at him and said, you have no idea.
You write a good amount here about why you moved to Tucson. One says you moved to Tucson to level up the adaptive traits you'll need to survive climate change. I mean,
and the kindness of strangers.
And the kindness of strangers. Like, that's a beautiful contrast there, right?
I will say the kindness of strangers freaks me out still sometimes, because Tucson does feel like a small town within a city. And I'm used to feeling somewhat anonymous. Like when I want to just disappear into my own world, my own thoughts, I'm used to being able to do that in bigger mm-hmm. cities. And in Tucson, it's harder because inevitably I'll run into a million people I know. And I've been here for a short time. People are so warm and welcoming. And that's incredible and just new to somebody who's used to being guarded yeah. from living in a larger city.
So I know you haven't been in Tucson all that long, and you're still sort of trying to figure out how you feel about and in this place. But I mean, so far, like as you're writing about it, observing it, gathering these thoughts together, especially as you make a book out of it, I mean, how do you think Tucson is changing you?
It's changed me in that in larger cities like Los Angeles, so many people are trying to do the same thing, mm-hmm. that it feels oversaturated, and you end up playing shows for all your friends.
Yeah.
Rather than the strangers.
Yeah.
I feel so embraced here in a way that's like a full body sigh, where I'm fully myself, creating everything I want, being as weird as I want to be. And I don't feel shy about it. I don't feel nervous about how it's going to look.
All right. Well, that is Britt Warner, an artist in Tucson. The In Tucson book is coming out in October. Britt, thank you so much for coming on the show. It was great to talk to you.
Lauren, thanks for having me.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody. The federal government has finally released details of new rules for allocating Colorado River water. The feds last month unveiled a framework for how cuts might work. Now that framework has been filled in with big cuts to the lower basin states of Arizona, California, and Nevada. With me now to talk about what all of this looks like is KJZZ's Alex Hager. Hey, Alex.
Good morning, Mark.
So let's go back to late July when this framework came out. Remind us like what that all looked like, what that all entailed.
Yeah, the big headline was that the federal government said two things. One, we're going to put out this framework that will manage the river for the next 10 years, but we're going to do new plans in two-year increments within those 10 years. So basically every 2 years, we're going to get all of the policymakers together and tweak the exact amount of water reductions we're making over the course of 2 years in response to river conditions. That was the first thing. The second thing they said was, we are giving ourselves the authority. We believe we have the legal authority to cut water for the lower basin states of Arizona, California, Nevada by up to 40%. So those were the two things that made waves here in Arizona.
And at the time, Arizona folks, water officials and others, they weren't that thrilled with all that.
That's right. They spent the last few weeks expressing that pretty vocally. I mean, they said that these cuts could be catastrophic to the people and economy of this state. They have long described the potential for cuts of that size as devastating. And they made the case to the federal government that they needed to adopt the counterproposal from Arizona, California, Nevada that would soften the blow of those cuts and avoid the most devastating, most catastrophic outcome.
So how closely did the federal government kind of hew to what the lower basin states wanted?
Well, we know that they chose not the worst option in the eyes of the lower basin states. They are going to cut water by about 20%. This is actually a combination of two things. So they are going to mandate a certain amount of cuts, and then in conjunction with that, Arizona, California, and Nevada are volunteering additional cuts. Hmm. And that all adds up to a little more than 20% of the water that typically in the past few years has flowed to Arizona, California, Nevada.
So it could have been worse.
It absolutely could have been worse. And it still could. That's the big thing is so far in the limited reaction we've seen since these rules came out less than an hour ago, we have seen some leaders saying, look, this is a bridge. This is not a permanent solution. We expect these rules to last. We know these rules will last for 2 years. And in October of 2028, we are going to have some new ones. So we still could see the kinds of catastrophic, drastic cuts starting in 2028 that Arizona's been talking about. But we know that for at least 2 years, there's a little bit of stability, knowing that these lower basin states are not going to have that worst case outcome.
Upper basin states have been making the case that they shouldn't take any cuts at all. Lower basin states, of course, disagree with that. What did the Fed say about the upper basin?
The upper basin states are not going to be required to make mandatory water cutbacks under this new plan. So that's Colorado, Utah, Wyoming, and New Mexico. They have long argued that they already take cuts. Even if they are not mandated by the government, their argument is that they have a legal obligation to send a certain amount of water down basically every year to Arizona, California, and Nevada. But because the river starts in those upper states as snow in the Rocky Mountains, they say low snow years, which we've been having a lot of lately, throw that balance out of whack. Basically, they have to send a fixed amount of water down every year, but the amount of water they are given to send has been a lot lower. Mm. And the difference, they say, amounts to the kind of cuts that the federal government might otherwise mandate.
So 20%, a little more than 20% cuts to Arizona, California, Nevada. What might that mean? What might that look like here?
Well, the interesting thing is it's not going to show up at your home or business for the most part. These cuts are not a surprise. The Colorado River has been really sagging under drought and climate change for 26 years now. And these kinds of cuts, maybe not the specific amount, but this kind of cut has been on the radar of the people who manage our water here for a long time. And for the most part, the cities that are going to be hit the hardest have been putting contingency plans into place for the better part of a decade. And because of that, the utilities that bring water to our homes have a huge backup plan in place.
So in theory, then, as you say, like, we're not in a situation where, like, we're going to turn on our tap and nothing's going to come out, or there's not going to be water for the kinds of things that we need.
I can say with almost universal certainty that that will be the case, at least for the next 2 years.
Right.
Most cities and utilities have a diverse water portfolio, so they're not just getting water from the Colorado River. So when you cut into the amount of water that those cities can access from the Colorado River, they can just lean harder on one of those other sources of water, groundwater, for example, water from the Salt River. And even cities that don't have these robust portfolios where they can go and get water from another system, there are exchanges in place where cities that have a lot of water are entering deals to share some of it with cities that don't.
So what might the next 2 years look like? Because as you say, like, this could get worse in 2 years. Is there a sense that the states might start, or maybe they've already started talking about what the 2028 version of this might look like?
I am going to make an educated guess here and say that the states have not necessarily done that. Okay. They have spent basically the last 2+ years negotiating over the rules that came out today, and they could not come to an agreement. They failed to agree.
Which is why the feds had to step in.
Exactly. And so the 7 leaders from the 7 states that use water from the Colorado River, they do not see eye to eye on how it should be shared. That is the reason that we are in this position today. They have spent a lot of time in closed-door meetings disagreeing with each other. So the idea that they have to go back quickly and restart those negotiations is probably pretty unsavory to most of the people who have lost a lot of sleep over the same negotiations for a couple years now.
So would that indicate, and of course, this is very speculative at this point, but like, is it a reasonable assumption then that there's at least a chance that the feds might have to step in 2028 and do this whole process again and say, okay, states, this is what we're telling you to do, as opposed to you figuring out for yourselves?
There is definitely a chance that that happens. I think the federal government has made it very clear that they do not want it to happen. The states, for the most part, also do not want it to happen. These guidelines, this 10-year system that I've been talking about, it is designed to allow the states to agree and kind of throw everything else out the window. So they said they're going to keep all meeting together, the state leaders, the federal leaders, and if they can put their heads together and come to a consensus, they kind of just scrap the plans we've been talking about today and replace them with the new ones. They would prefer to agree, and they've built a system that accommodates that.
Alex, we've been hearing a lot about lawsuits potentially in the state setting aside money for that. Do you get the sense that might still be on the table, or since the feds basically adopted what the lower basin states had asked for, that maybe that's not going to be an issue right now?
I would say we are not out of the woods yet on that. The states have been quietly jostling around and hinting that they could take this to court if they wanted to. I have not yet seen Arizona's reaction to today's announcement.
Sure.
But in their most recent reaction, they said, look, remember, we are not going to sue.
Okay. We'll see what happens. That is KJZZ's Alex Hager. Alex, thanks as always.
Good to be back, Mark.
It is now time for the next installment of our summer soapbox series. Some road trips are planned for months in advance and carefully mapped out, while others, like the one taken by writer and photographer Morgan Cabasco, are more impromptu.
The golden rule of improv is yes and. And so was my golden rule for the summer of 2023. That summer felt like a true summer. I had finished my sophomore year of college, moved off campus with a part-time job, and a handful of my out-of-state college friends were staying in Arizona for the break. My friend Alex and I spent nearly every weekend together. We soaked in the sun, window shopped at the mall, and took a number of impromptu road trips. As any other Arizona native can attest, the optimal summer plan is avoiding the 115-degree weather. Logically, Flagstaff or Prescott would be the perfect destination for a day trip outside of Tempe, but we thought, why not think bigger? Alex and I shared a love of the beach and decided that the roughly 12-hour drive to San Diego and back was something we could accomplish in a day. Our first trek further west began at 5 a.m. at the end of May. Alex's apartment was in downtown Phoenix, so we figured I'd spend the night there, as if being 20 minutes closer was going to make the trip feel any shorter. We fueled up on Red Bull and gas station snacks, blared a chaotic playlist of songs, and yapped each other's ears off while we drove. As Alex and a handful of my friends can attest, vulnerability is not my strong suit. While I am a lover of intellectual conversations and opinionated debates, being open about myself is something different. But there is something special about a road trip conversation. The open road provides a fluid space where small chat blossoms into deeper dialogues. There are only so many songs you can sing along to before the lack of conversation becomes apparent. We started by discussing work, love lives, nights out, and as the cacti turned into palm trees, we dove into career goals, hardships, and everything in between. Those conversations followed us out of Alex's old white Jeep and onto the beach and into restaurants and shops. And when the time finally came to head back to the desert, we were closer friends who didn't want the trip to end. If you thought doing a day trip to San Diego was already ambitious, we decided watching fireworks at Disneyland would be the perfect end cap to the day. Despite the fact we already had a long drive back, we switched directions, traveled farther up the coast, and sat in downtown Disney while a pattern of flashes lit up the night sky. The drive back home was exactly what you'd expect. A little delirium mixed with a growing desire to be in bed. But even when we fought against our heavy eyelids and took turns sleeping, we still managed to maintain moments of banter. Those times of connection were what made that summer feel like a true summer. Spur-of-the-moment adventures and saying yes to the little things created a special magic that radiated beyond car doors.
That was writer and photographer Morgan Cabasco. You can hear her story again and find more Soapbox essays at kjzz.org. Thanks for listening to the show's podcast. The show is produced by Sativa Peterson, Nick Sanchez, Amber Victoria Singer, Athena Ankra, and Ayanna Hamilton. The show was created by John Hoban. Our executive producer is Amy Silverman. You can find more of the show and sign up for our newsletter at theshow.kjzz.org. You can also find us on Instagram at kjzztheshow.